We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain-sensing headband that helps you build or deepen your meditation practice and keep your brain healthy. And Meditation Studio, the five-star app. I'm Patricia Karpus. Don't forget to check out the hundreds of free meditations on Meditation Studio app. Find out more at choosemuse.com/meditationstudio. We're getting very close to the holidays and the new year, and many of us are feeling joyful. Others are remembering those they've lost and miss, and may be experiencing different kinds of grief. This interview is really for anyone, all of us actually, that have ever felt the sting of loss. Our guest is Gina Maffa, clinical social worker and author of the book, Moving On Doesn't Mean Letting Go, A Modern Guide to Navigating Loss. Gina is wise, compassionate, and very passionate about this complicated topic. We talk about how difficult loss can be, especially in a culture where we're encouraged to stay strong and keep our feelings to ourselves. But she says, we don't have to choose between falling apart or staying strong while grieving our losses. The art of living lies in the fine mingling of letting go and holding on. Grief hurts whether it's the death of someone you love, the end of a friendship, a breakup, or an ambiguous loss. We all experience it. And even though it's one of our most universal human journeys, it isn't something most of us know how to do. It can be isolating, confusing, and profoundly painful. Gina gives us a toolkit, if you will, to wade through these difficult feelings. We're all grieving something at some time, so this would be a book I'd like to share with everyone I know. Now, here's Gina. Gina, it's great to have you on Untangle today, talking about one of my favorite topics. So thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Patricia. So good to be here with you.
Yeah. So let's start by, I want to define grief, but before we do that, I want you to talk a little bit about why you chose this topic to specialize in your practice.
Sure. I fell into grief, I guess we could say. I started out as a trauma therapist and somebody really, really interested and passionate about talking about trauma. But what I realized in the course of my career was that you couldn't have trauma without talking about loss. And you couldn't really have a lot of mental health challenges without talking about the effects of loss inherent within them. And so it started to dawn on me that we as a society just weren't talking enough about that. And we weren't talking enough about grief in general. And so I started to do a lot of my work in tandem, trauma work in tandem with grief work. And I flipped a little bit more into the grief world when there wasn't any grief groups being given in the summers while I was working at the 92nd Street Y, as if grief took a vacation too. And so I started to do more groups during that particular period of time and just started to do more of it. And obviously with the COVID-19 pandemic, really loss and grief became very much in the forefront. And it became really the sole focus within my practice just because of the need.
Do you feel like once people open up, they're comfortable talking about grief?
The jury is still out on that. I think it depends on what they've lost. I think people are more comfortable talking about death-related losses, but I do find that a lot of clients coming into my office really still struggle with things like friendship loss or pet loss because of really, I think, the judgment from society and the shame inherent within when it comes to how long we're allowed to grieve or what kind of grief it is. And it's really interesting how society can really place value on what they deem worthy of being grieved and for how long. So, yeah.
So frustrating. And I wonder if it has anything to do with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's 5 stages of grief. And then people are like, well, I'm not in that stage. And I didn't go in that order. And maybe that confused us a little bit because a lot of what you talk about is we all grieve differently and we need permission to do that. And community. And what do you think of the 5 stages of grief that she proclaimed?
I have so much respect for Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And I think for her, when she created that, the 5 stages of grief and that structure, she had it specifically designed for people who were terminally ill. And when you think of it that way, there is a clear ending. And so it makes sense. When we use it as grievers, and I give her so much credit because I think being left behind and being in that state of loss, especially the early shocking stages of loss, it's really so unpredictable and turbulent that I think having some semblance of a structure so people aren't flailing in the dark was wonderful. But I think we took it too far in not really explaining that there is no beginning, middle, and end, and that these stages are, if you do use them in any capacity, that you will cycle through them again and again and again in no particular order, in addition to many other experiences that you will have, both physically and otherwise and spiritually even. But I respect her so much for the purpose with which she created the 5 stages of grief. And I think it shows, if anything, that society really does need a template of some kind, especially in a really unpredictable emotional state. I really respect her for that purpose.
Yeah, I think I like what you're saying about needing a template, because otherwise, how do we know how to prepare, or even as we're younger, to build up our capacity for navigating loss, endings, death? It's not like it's a course in grade school. We never learn it. You learn by experience. And if things happen out of order, you're in college and a parent dies, and most of your friends still have their parents, you don't have a way to think about that. And there are so many groups like that. Things don't happen when they're supposed to happen, and there's no one to talk to that's in that same boat with you. So how do you think about that?
I think that what we have to do with society right now is to create more grief literacy and more proficiency and grief vocabulary in education and in healthcare and in community settings, because I do believe that it's such a lonely and isolating experience, despite the fact that it is so individual and despite the fact that everyone will have their own way of coping. But I do believe if we could teach at the very least that grief is a full body experience, that it is okay and normal for it to be present as long as it is, and yet that it shouldn't be indefinite without a sense of relief or a lessening in intensity at the very least, but that there are ways that we can have a sense of agency even when we do feel like we're flailing in the dark. And so I do believe in the idea of a bottom-up approach and really working with the body as much as possible, because I think doing any work with grief cognitively, not many people can really understand what that is, number one, but it doesn't really get to the heart of the matter. But mostly, I think that if we could provide some sense of understanding and education and literacy around grief, perhaps we could learn how to engage and befriend it in a much different way, a much healthier way as a society.
Why do some of us respond so differently to loss? I have a dear friend who lost his father when he was 13 years old, and he doesn't really remember the grief of it. He remembers they went to school, life went on. He doesn't seem like he's harboring anything now. He seems to have accepted it in a way that I have other friends who may have lost a parent when they were 8 years old and hold on to that as an abandonment issue for their entire lives. What makes us deal with grief differently? And maybe you can weave in your definition of grief as we talk about that, because I personally feel like there are so many layers of grief.
Absolutely. In its simplest form, grief is really the result and the natural response to any loss that is significant to us. And that means death-related loss. It can mean loss of livelihood, job, identity, sense of safety, our health. It can be things that we actually even haven't ever had, but wish we did have. So the friend with the abandonment wound, that is quintessentially that sense of deep existential grief of something that we longed for, but never had. But I do think that when we lose something, it is really the attachment and the meaning of the attachment and the depth of the attachment that gives loss the depth and the intensity. And so that could mean one friend has a different depth of attachment than another friend, or it can mean they maybe a parent was around more, they had a closer relationship with that person, or maybe the ways in which the family confronted emotions was more transparent or more present than another family member or another family. And so I think it really is the way that we are raised, the way that we are raised to look and engage and befriend, again, our emotions and our emotional experiences, or even painful things that happen. I have clients that come into my office and because maybe cultural reasons, don't have any memory either of really major losses and don't have an emotional connection to them. That is a part of the story. And then as you unravel that a little bit more, there is loss in there, but it's loss in a nuanced way, in a way that now that I'm feeling this so much, I'm feeling like I missed out on something. And it could be there and it may not be, depending on how we provide a sense of meaning to attachment itself.
The poet and writer Parker Palmer, who's 82 or 83 now, says that we train in grief by dealing with the little heartbreaks of everyday life so that when the big ones come, we're not completely shattered. You have this list in the book of things you were just talking about, all the different types of losses, loss of identity, of hope, of health, of a job, of a relationship. When you are counseling someone, how do you begin to help them open up to what they're feeling and then help them move through it? And I guess at the end of it all, you're hoping that grief can be integrated, those feelings can be integrated into your body, into your life, into your heart, and you can move on.
I think just like the grief experience, we all come with our own ways of coping. And so I also talk about grief rhythms and how we all cope with things in our own rhythms. And that even means how we even come to both allow and experience our emotions and our feelings. So some people may come to me and not actually have the ability to feel their feelings because there's somebody who maybe intellectualizes. And so they can report and they know how they feel, but they may not have ever really experienced feeling them. Or maybe the idea of feeling feelings is terrifying. I talk a lot about this in my book, but my first priority is always going to be safety. And providing a sense of consistent safety within the relationship is really how we can look at just not just the loss itself, but how have you felt feelings? How have you coped with difficult things in your life before? Because this is not going to be an isolated, painful event. It really is important to look at the whole picture of a person's life and their painful experiences, as well as their strengths and their coping mechanisms and how they have gotten through before. Do they have a good support system or maybe not? Do they tend to lick their own wounds in a dark corner somewhere? And I think really getting to that nitty gritty of how people cope individually, where they find safety, where they find comfort, if at all, is really the first starting point in helping them to both acknowledge and feel, but also then move through those emotions and try to come to a place of, I wouldn't say we get to integrating really quickly, but really being able to allow in other life experiences that may not feel comfortable at first, because it may feel if you've had a death-related loss, like you're leaving something behind or Maybe you have guilt over being happy again, or you fear memories fading, or you ruminate so often about the what ifs and the would have, could have, should have's. And so I think working through that is so much more important first, but also then being able to allow in the good over time and slowly. I think we always jump to the good parts, right? Can we skip to the good part is something that we hear on social media a lot. As a therapist, I cringe because I'm like, no, the good part isn't where the growth is. It isn't where our edges are. It isn't where the most rewarding part of the journey will eventually unfold from. And so that's really how I would approach that.
Yeah, I think people are so uncomfortable with sitting with discomfort. And in the mindfulness and Buddhist tradition, it's all about learning to be with your pain. Sounded like what you were talking about was maybe what you describe in the book as your own personal inner grief journey. You start the book talking about a grief fall. It's a word you made up, right? Grief fall?
Yes.
Mushed together, grief and fall.
I put them together.
That's okay. We love made up words. What is a grief fall?
I created the word grief fall because to me, it was the most visual and visceral word that I could come up with that actually felt like it described the initial shock of grief, right? It's that moment, I call it the portal to grieving. It's that moment where nothing is ever the same. It's that moment where you get the phone call, which I do in my book. It's the moment where you get the news that you have your diagnosis, or you realize that your pet has taken its last breath. That one moment, it's a split second. And anyone who's experienced this may understand it's like a free fall. It's like you're falling and falling and you have no idea where you're going to land, but you know that nothing will ever be the same and that something is now irreversibly changed. And it felt like I couldn't just call that grief. I couldn't just call that loss, because that moment is the moment that defines so many of us. We'll always remember that one moment where we close our eyes and we'll say, I remember where I was when. I remember where I was when I got that news, or when I got the call, or when I got that diagnosis, whatever it may be. And I felt like we needed to really honor that in such a tender way, but also a truthful way. So I came up with this word, and it's meaningful to me because I do feel like so many of us are able to remember those moments, and how wonderful that we could at least put a name to that moment.
Yeah. And that's the moment we need to talk about. Not just hold on to ourselves. You have a quote in the book. I think it's by Havelock Ellis. All the art of living lies in a fine mingling of letting go and holding on.
That's a good one.
That is a good one. I mean, it really is all about how we choose to live our lives and where we have choice. I feel like with grief, often you feel like you have no choice. It just sits inside of you. It's like an elephant sitting on your shoulders until you can let it go. And so we don't feel like we have choice. And I like what you were saying too about it being tied to how attached and connected we are to those we love, because that's the beauty of the grief too. But we can't see it in the beginning. And we can't see it when something tragic happened. I think I was telling you yesterday, my sister's dog was hit by a car and she saw it happening. And so in her grief of losing the dog, she's also traumatized by that horrible incident. And that happens a lot, tragic accidents. And how do you give your clients or your readers tools for those kinds of situations? And I know you have a whole chapter on trauma in the book.
I do. First, I'm just really wanted to reach out to your sister and say how sorry I am, because losing a beloved pet in that way so shockingly is really hard. And so I just have to say that first. But for so many of my clients too, one of the things that is really hard to understand is that we have to look at the way that the trauma is interacting with the grief. And so if your sister were to come and work with me, it would be more about really understanding that the trauma response is what we have to work with, and to really find ways to process the trauma first, because we need to stabilize those symptoms and decrease those trauma symptoms and the rumination and the potential PTSD that can come up with traumatic loss, and really increase coping skills or really work with what the rumination is. So I would look at processing the trauma first, creating safety, doing trauma work specifically, and then later diving into the grief work. And so with traumatic loss, it really is a two-pronged approach with stabilization of trauma and working with that trauma, the moments that you can't remember, the moments that replay in your mind, the nightmares, the physical sensations, the endless panic attacks, the anxiety, and really work with that from a bottom-up approach, which is a body-first approach. I am an EMDR practitioner. I believe in it. I have seen it take the sting out of really, really painful traumatic events using the brain and bilateral stimulation. And I say this a lot, it's close to hocus pocus as one can get in an actually the most scientifically researched modality in therapy, but I believe in it. I've seen it work. And especially with traumatic loss, I think that there are somatic therapies, EMDR being just one of them, but also somatic work, brain spotting, et cetera, that could really be the most beneficial first. And then after that, I would dive into the grief work, which is really getting a chance to look at the narrative that we tell ourselves and the story and finding ways to honor that loss and really get into it in that particular order. Because it is important too, not just to take the sting out of the trauma, but also to honor the loss and to really honor the relationship and honor what's next. So that's what I would do.
Yeah. And it's so interesting how different people respond to these kinds of traumas. I think of some other friends who choose to distract themselves very quickly. Either they have something happens, maybe it's a loss of a partner, but you have young children to take care of. And so you jump into that and you're never really dealing with the trauma. You're moving forward with your life and step by step doing exactly what you have to do. Is that a common response that you see? And some people have this ability to do that?
It really does depend on somebody's ability to cope, to be honest, because it's our nervous system. If we were born with a more overactive nervous system, we might not be able to jump back into that sense, even if we had a duty towards it, or even if we had really urgent matters to take care of, it would be a lot harder to do that. If for somebody who has high anxiety, high adrenaline, that would be nearly impossible to run back into. But if we are somebody who has, say, for lack of a better word, and more normal functioning nervous system that's not always scanning for danger and death, then yeah, I talk about that also in my grief rhythms, because it is more than just a rhythm for grieving, but the coping mechanisms. And the first one is the survivor, which is somebody who maybe doesn't have the luxury, quote unquote, of grieving or tending to their emotions or sensations. And so they really do have to caretake, or they have to get back to work because they, for financial reasons, can't afford to actually take off and process their trauma or their grief. And if that is the case, that is fairly normal. You know, I see that in there. That's why I call it one of the 8 common grieving rhythms, because we all have a rhythm when we're coping with painful things, whether it is a big loss, a traumatic loss, or any other painful or challenging life event. We all have a way of coping with it. We all have our go-tos. And I think it's important to understand that, not just so we understand the way that we do cope with things, but the way in which we may need to cope with things in a healthier way, or the things we may need to go to in order to process something or to be present with something that's painful. It's a good start, but yeah, it is really hard to figure out what to do next.
It's all really hard. On this show, we talk a lot about mindfulness and meditation. We talk about self-care and exercise and journaling. And what are some of the go-tos when you're, even if you don't feel like you can do them in that moment, should you do them even if you're not motivated, because it will be helpful in the end?
Again, for me, it does depend on where you are in your process. So for somebody who's experienced the initial shock of loss, I always say, first and foremost, as lame or simple as it may sound, to shrink your world a little bit and take it to basics. And I make sure, and it's just like what you're saying is self-care, but I call it survival care. So we do have to make sure we're drinking enough water and eating enough protein and moving our body in a way that's not necessarily getting our fight or flight activated, but something slower. Maybe it is Pilates or yoga, or maybe it's stretching, or maybe it's taking a walk in nature. Something that can actually not put us in a state of our nervous system thinking that we're running from a bear, because we're already in that. And so getting enough rest, even if we can't sleep, because these things are a full body experience. And so I love everything that you say on the podcast and on the app. I'm a huge champion of being mindful, especially in really, really painful, difficult times in our lives, because coming back and being able to ground ourselves in some way, coming back to center, coming back to our breath, is really almost a saving grace, especially with trauma when our nervous system is so out of whack. It's like a smoke alarm. And that's what's going on during grief too. So really anything we can do to get our nervous system to try to calm itself or be centered, I am also a champion of. So, but it could also be things just like art therapy, the somatic therapies I was telling you before. There's yoga for grief, yoga for trauma. There's very specific types of movement. I'm really big in getting into nature if you can. And if that's a possibility, or other types of therapies that can get you your window of tolerance a little bit more expanded in terms of what we're able to actually contend with in any moment. So anything that can keep you as centered as possible. I love journaling. I love letter writing when it comes to grief and writing letters to our loved ones who are no longer with us, or our pets, or even just estranged relatives. It could be any kind of loss in that way. So I really do love the idea of getting it out of our bodies, but also getting us centered in our bodies. So if it comes to trauma and grief, we can't just work with the neck up. It just won't work. So we've got to get the whole body involved.
Thank you for saying. We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. We talk about these often on Untangle. When we keep things bottled up inside, it can start to impact our health mentally, emotionally, and physically. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, whatever it is. If this sounds like you, and it's a bit of all of us, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule and needs. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now, over to Untangle. In the book, you say, but there are a few truths about grief that can help start the process and give you a sense of agency during an experience that can threaten to take you down. What are these truths?
Gosh, there are so many. One of the truths is really about our expectations. So if we're comparing our loss to somebody else's loss, we're going to find our way into a state of despair. If we think that loss or grief is just the experience of the 5 stages, we are going to be thrown into a trauma response because we're going to think that we've failed. And that is not something that we can do. And also that grief is going to be as long as it is, but there are ways to work with it. Grief will be our companion. If it's the death of something or someone very significant to us, it will always be with us. But the hope is that the intensity levels will lessen, but to really understand that this isn't a quick fix. There's no cure to grief. And even in a bottom-up somatic therapies, we're working with symptoms and we're working with integrating an experience, but that doesn't cure. It doesn't cure the experience. And so really to find a way to manage our expectations, both of ourselves and of our experience, is really one of the first steps.
Yeah, because we want to save the love we had and let go of the pain of the loss.
What can be so hard for some people is that we're constantly trying to wrap our brains around something first. Loss is a trauma to the brain in that we know that there's a person and it's in their predictable place in our lives in space and time. And when they're taken from us, we are trying to simultaneously attach still stronger to the connection of this person, but also now try to take them out of space and time. And that's a really hard thing to do. And we are always trying to rush again to, how do I make meaning? Or how do I get past this? Or what do I do now? And it is really hard for the brain to contend with this. And so that's why I say, please be patient. It is a tender process. It really is. And it needs that patience.
Yeah. Thank you so much for saying that. So there's this inner world that we've been talking about and how we navigate that. And now you also write about navigating the outer world with grief and how difficult. And I've observed this myself. Some people are so uncomfortable with another person's loss. And many people have no idea what to say. And sometimes what they say is so ridiculous. You've got some examples in the book.
I do. Many.
What do you say? Heaven has another angel or something. And you're like, really? That does not make me feel better.
Yeah, it was a client who, it was heaven had another angle. So the person didn't even care to spell check what they wrote on social media. And so it made it even much more of a disconnect and a painful disconnect at that.
What advice would you give people who are dealing with their friends or family who have had losses? I feel your pain. It sucks. I can't even imagine what you're going through. What else? What can we say?
I think one of the things that is common sense, but something society does lack sometimes with grief, especially, is somebody who's going through a loss already feels as though they've been picked up and transported to this foreign landscape. They have no idea where they are. They know they have to rebuild, but they are searching for the tools. Nothing looks familiar. They don't look familiar even to themselves. And then they have people coming to them saying things that feel very alien. It's like a body snatcher comes, right? If your best friend is always snarky and sarcastic with you and the straight shooter, and they come to you and they say, well, gee, Patricia, I'm so sorry for your loss. Heaven just surely gained another angel. Another angel has gotten its wings, or she's in a better place. Not only do you not feel better, but you feel as though you don't even recognize this person now. And somebody who once brought you comfort and familiarity is now also a total alien in your life. And so one of the things I say is, please show up as you. As you show up as you would show up to somebody that you love and someone you're close with. If you are sarcastic, it's okay to still be you and say, well, that sucks, doesn't it? You're not having a great year. Maybe if that's your relationship. And so for me, it's to be as honest and awkward as you possibly can be, even if it's you saying, I'm really shit at death, but I know this is awkward and I am so awkward, but I love you and I want you to know I'm here and I'm happy to sit with you and say nothing, or we can sit and talk about your loss, but I'm going to come over at 5. And if that still works for you, I'm going to bring some food, or I can bring food tomorrow and leave it on your steps, whatever it is to do, to take the onus and responsibility out of the hands of the griever, because a griever is trying to process and learn so much and deal with so much and navigate something that's so completely unpredictable and upending. If we can just be as honest and authentic as possible to do as many tangible, concrete things for the person as possible, but also just to say, I love you and this sucks, just like you said earlier, that's enough. That's enough.
Yeah. Nora McInerney has a podcast called Terrible, Thanks for Asking. And I always think about that, because when you say, how are you, to somebody who's just been through something or is going through something, it's an invitation for them to be able to say, terrible, thanks for asking. But we don't feel comfortable doing that in our culture. But I think her podcast is actually quite funny, even though it's about really horrible things. So I like that one too.
It's a great podcast. We need more of that. We need more of that, because the humor in it is truth. And our society does take in truth a little bit easier if it has a little bit of a lighter, more humorous spin to it, unfortunately. But I do. I love that one. And it's so true. I think the best we could say is, how are you doing today? How is today for you? Because every day will be different for somebody. But I think we're so used to getting it wrong that sometimes people don't say anything at all. or they are so nervous that they do say the wrong things. And the wrong things are just things that are thoughtless or inauthentic.
Yeah, mistakes.
Yeah. And we've all made them, right? We make them until we know better. Even I say it in the book, I didn't always know the right thing to say. I said many wrong things until I was lovingly redirected. And we take that learning, thankfully, and use it and pass that on is my hope.
As you were saying, small steps. I went to a course called Complicated Grief a couple of years ago. And one of the tools that they had suggested was a grief scale. And in your journal, like on a scale of 1 to 10, and 10's horrible, just write down how you feel each day. Today I'm a 10, today I'm a 9. I'm 10 again. I'm 8 today. And at least it helps you to feel like you're making a little bit of progress. And maybe that is inspiring.
Absolutely. And I love that because grief is on a spectrum. It isn't a just black and white, I'm great, I'm not great. It's I'm doing less great today, but maybe looking at this scale, I'm doing better than I was yesterday. Wow. That's hopeful, but also not to punish yourself if you're having a 3 day and yesterday you had a 10 day, because that is also grief. It is the spectrum of mystery, as I call it.
I think knowing that it changes is helpful. So if you have a 10 day where you're crying in your closet all day, tomorrow could be a 3. And you know that because you have that experience. One of the things that I think about often that I am not very good at as a sensitive person, but how do we learn to compartmentalize? So we're grieving, we're still grieving, and we're grieving some more, but we have to function as a parent or as an employee or as anything that we do in our daily life. What are some ways that would help us be able to compartmentalize?
I think that one of the things people do is because humans are a little extreme. I don't know if you know that. We tend towards the extreme side. And so we tend to push it away, right? So compartmentalize in our culture, we put it away and we never look at it again. And that feels terrible, but it feels like the right thing to do. But the truth is that compartmentalizing it is really supposed to be just a safety measure for the time being. So if we have to go to work and we don't have a grief literate workplace, which many of them are not, unfortunately, and maybe we can't go to the bathroom every 5 minutes and cry, but maybe we can go once or twice a day, but we're able to say, okay, I'm going to create this box and I'm going to put everything I need to in it emotionally. But the caveat is that I'm going to actually right here and now schedule a time to come back to this box. And in my mind's, I'm going to then open this box up and take everything out that I was looking at earlier in the day or that I wanted to look at earlier in the day or feel or think about. And it does take a little bit of imagination in terms of creating this box, but it's called a container and it is an EMDR exercise. And I do talk about that also in my book, but I do think that there's nothing wrong with compartmentalization. I do think that what happens is we do that as a habit. It becomes our pattern and our coping mechanism. And we don't actually come back and revisit any of the things that were really painful or the emotions that needed to arise and be felt and acknowledged. And that's where we fall short for ourselves. So that's why I say my caveat is if you need to do that, and that is okay. And even if it could be that you don't have something necessarily urgent and pressing, but you actually just need a distraction because you've been so inundated with your grief and the grief experience, this is healthy. We don't have to grieve indefinitely. We are allowed to take breaks. We can binge a Netflix show. It is okay to do this. We can't constantly be bombarded by painful feelings and experiences. My caveat again is just that we need to make sure that we come back and tend to those feelings at a time that it feels safe enough to do so. And we have to be responsible enough with ourselves and our emotional lives to say, all right, I'm busy, but maybe I have from 10 to 10:45 tonight. Well, great. I know you might be tired, but at least be present with yourself in a way that feels authentic. Just even sit and put your hand on your heart. So we have to find a way to come back to those things and those feelings without keeping them in there forever in this dusty closet that we tend to sometimes leave them in.
Oh, that was so well put. What role does self-compassion have in managing our grief rhythm?
I think self-compassion is right up there with self-care, drinking enough water, eating enough nourishing food, because like I said earlier, we're always looking for a point of reference, especially in an unpredictable journey like grief. If we're starting to compare ourselves to other people, judgment is going to be the first thing that we invite in, self-judgment or gaslighting. We'll say, well, it wasn't as bad as Sally down the block's loss of her child. And when we start doing that, not only are we minimizing our experience and dismissing ourselves, but we're dismissing the very thing that we're grieving. And it's really, really important that we come forward and we say, okay, I'm going through this really hard time. What do I need? What is it that my body is calling for? What is it that my heart is looking for right now? Is there anything that can bring me comfort? And if this judging voice comes up, to thank this judging voice for trying to be protective. However, you've got it, and that you need to replace this with as much compassion and patience as possible, because it is really a tenuous and turbulent path, grieving.
We're talking so much about death here. Some of these principles certainly apply to other losses that aren't as maybe significant, but loss of a relationship, loss of a job, moving from one chapter of your life to another. For these types of changes, these are really navigating endings and integrating this idea of hope for the new beginning. What's some advice for navigating those types of what we might call less crushing losses? Still crushing.
They can be so crushing. And that's exactly what we want to change in society. You've been conditioned to say that, Patricia. So
I am conditioned.
We all are, right? We've all been conditioned to think that death loss is the worst of the worst. And yet we have so many other losses in our lives that change our lives or redefine us. And that doesn't involve death. That maybe at times feels like death would be a welcome respite for us in some way. I hate to say that, but there are really, really painful life events. So I'm even thinking of family estrangements or divorces that we didn't see coming, things like that. And it is really very much the same. I think we still do, no matter what type of loss it is, we still jump to judgment. We go to shame. We go to self-comparison. And one of the things I always say is that we have to bring honesty to our lives, to our losses. We have to look at our lives honestly. And one of the things that it feels people do is then they self-blame and they minimize everything. And the truth is that these are devastating and crushing losses that they mattered and they deserve to be tended to with equal gentleness and equal attention and acknowledgement. And a lot of the exercises I talk about in my book, whether they're yoga for grief or whatever it may be, the movement and all of that really is still so applicable to non-death losses, because we're still processing things through us. And we're in that place where we're saying to ourselves, okay, what's next? What do I do now? Who am I now? I have a client whose children are growing and they're starting to individuate from her. And this is a positive loss, right? In a way, because they're doing what kids do, should do. We want our children to grow up and have their own identity and start to separate. But that moment of separation brings its own nuanced, layered grief. And people don't even recognize that. So it's just important, even non-soul crushing losses, but positive change can bring so much loss. It's really just a matter of being able to witness it, acknowledge it, give it the light of day to brew and bring up all of the feelings that come with these things, these life changes, whether painful or positive, and do so in a way that respects them. Because I think what we really are missing in society is the permission to grieve and the permission to feel that grief. And not only the permission to feel it, but for other people to witness it and regard and respect it as a sacred part of our own journey as well as grief. That's where I would start.
One of the things I was thinking as I read your book was that people should read this book when they're not grieving, when they're not in a loss situation. They should read it when they definitely are. I did send it to my sister, but this idea of preparing and becoming more emotionally resilient so that when things do happen, we have tools in our toolkit so that we're not scrambling for what to do. So I know you've talked a lot about this, but I want you to summarize, like, what is in our emotional resilience for loss and grief toolbox?
We don't have a very good toolbox right now when it comes to society. I think that one of the things we have to do is to stop being so afraid of it. Everybody will lose. None of us are getting out of here unscathed. So we have to start being able to look at it. And so many people, like we started out our conversation, are so afraid of grief. And I don't know if we believe it's contagious or we believe that it won't stop once it starts, but we really need to become a more grief literate society. And that does come with education and being really honest about our losses. And that means really looking at all of the times, the milestones, the moments in our lives we have already lost and looking at them. But in terms of emotional resilience, I think that it starts with honesty. Like I just said, it starts with safety, feeling safe in our lives. And if we don't, trying to find a person, place, or event, something in our lives that create a sense of safety, whether that's a grief therapist or someone you can co-regulate with that's a healer in some way, because we shouldn't do this alone. And despite the fact that I do give exercises, I think I say ad nauseum that I don't want people to be grieving alone, because we're grieving a void, we're grieving a loss. And so if we're just doing it in our own, we're still in a void. And so when we have somebody's hand reach out and pull us out of the trenches or that dark, sticky tar pit, that's when we begin to see healing. That's when we begin to see possibility. That's when not only do we have hope, but we have something better than that. We have more action-oriented determination. And what hope inevitably becomes is determination to keep going, to create life that feels fulfilling and meaningful. But it does definitely take another person to witness us. And it takes us to have the courage and the bravery to share our pain with another person as honestly and openly as we can, and ourselves. And I feel really strongly about that, because I don't know how we become a better society for one another in any way anymore, unless we really can create a safe enough container for one another to be present in all of the muck of all of it. We need each other.
We need each other. And just in saying, like, the courage to share pain, you know, so many people are uncomfortable with that. And the people that they're sharing with are uncomfortable with that. So I really love that you're saying we need to be more grief literate, sad literate, pain literate, so that we can be there for each other without making it this big old heavy thing that makes everybody uncomfortable. It is a big old heavy thing, but to just be there and to share, I think, would be a great tribute.
Absolutely. When we look at the Eastern cultures and we look at loss, a whole community comes out together and everybody is present for this person pretty much across the board in Eastern cultures. Here, we're like, ooh, stay over there. I'll send you a card.
Or 3 days. We'll
3 days is enough for you. Best of luck. We'll see you back at the office like nothing ever happened. And we get to determine what is the most important loss, because if it's your pet, that doesn't really even get you 3 days. Unless it's an immediate, we get to decide as a society what we think is the most important loss. And meanwhile, you may have lost your best friend in a car accident and you're closer to this person than you've ever been to your birth family. And so to me, it's just such a backwards, messy society that it makes no sense when it comes to loss. And one of the things I feel most passionately about is really trying to use whatever platform I inevitably can create to find a way to make changes on a higher level, because we really have to do better for one another. We really do.
I completely agree. And like you started the conversation saying, we all go through grief so differently and in our own way and in our own time. So it's hard to create a template or a platform, but it's so important to do that and for us to take that moment to understand where someone else might be. You have so many examples of that in your book. I have two more questions. I could talk to you forever because this is my favorite topic.
I love it. Mine too.
Is there anything else that is significant that we may have missed in this conversation at the moment that you'd like to share?
I think that people are afraid to reach out for help. I do just really want to say that it doesn't always have to be. I mean, I'm coming from a clinical lens, but I'm also a meditator and I am somebody who is more spiritually bent. But I do believe that if you're somebody going through a loss, or maybe you don't know if you are, and putting your hand on your heart and saying, what losses am I carrying that I may not have known about? And that it's really okay to reach out for help. And I just feel like if people are feeling stuck, quote unquote, and their losses, that I say, I don't want you to not have relief, and I want your grief to have less intensity over time. And that is true. But if you're feeling shame and being stuck, please reach out. You don't have to be in this place that feels so dark all alone. So it just feels important for me to reiterate that.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And then the last question, which I ask all of our guests, is what three pieces of advice would you give your younger self?
Oh my goodness. I bet everyone has the same, oh my goodness, I need a minute kind of idea. It's so seldom that we think of our little selves. There's a part of me that thinks my little self had it right, of being present and being so honest and feeling what I felt and not running away from it. And I wish that I had always done that, and that I continue to do that, and I stopped hiding away thinking society wanted that for me and that that would be okay. So to keep feeling out loud would probably be one of the things I would tell her. And that it's okay to change, and that it's okay to grow. I think we're so afraid sometimes of being much different than we think society wants us to be, or our family wants us to be. So many family members will say, oh, you're so different, or there's the black sheep person in everybody's family, and there's something really important about that. And that was my role in a way. And so I want to celebrate the sheep that was the powerful little sheep. It's funny, I think as we grow, we're so hard on ourselves. And I was talking recently with somebody who asked a similar question. And I remember thinking, wow, I feel like I peaked when I was younger. And how now as a fully grown adult human, I feel so much more of that imposter syndrome. And as much education and training, 20 years of training and doing this work and putting a book out into the world and feeling like the biggest imposter, despite the fact that I have all of this training and education, and being so upset about that and feeling like, wow, how did little Gina peak so young? And so I guess I would say keep peaking in a way, to keep it going. I miss that in a way. That's at the top of my mind as we're talking today, was that conversation I just had. For most women who have to deal with this, and not saying men don't, it is more common for women to deal with imposter syndrome.
I totally agree. I think you're amazing, so articulate, so wise, and I'm sure you have had this wisdom at every age because it feels so natural to you. So thank you for sharing. It's a difficult topic, but it is so prescient in every part of us. So it's really important to talk about, and I just really love this conversation. So thank you so much.
Me too. Me too. Thank you so much for doing this and having me here and bringing light to the dark places.
Yeah. Thanks so much for joining us today. For more on Gina, check out her book. It's available at all major booksellers. More information about her is at her website, ginamaffa.com. Check out all the free meditations on Meditation Studio app. You can find them at choosemuse.com/meditationstudio. And as always, please reach out to us if you have suggestions or comments at untangle@choosemuse.com. We are wishing you all the best this holiday season. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.